What the future holds may indeed, as President Obama said today, depend on what young people think about going to the moon and beyond. Nell Greenfield Boyce went out in Washington, D.C. to ask some young people.
Laura Fabens-Lassen is from Philadelphia. She's 20 years old, so she was born years after Apollo ended and astronauts stopped walking on the moon.
When you think of the moon and people walking on the moon, how does that seem to you?
I'm not really fazed by that. It doesn't seem particularly... It doesn't seem like a big ordeal to me.
If they had another moon landing and it was sort of on TV, would you be watching it?
Yeah, absolutely, I'd watch it. Definitely.
Someone her age only knows about moonwalking from movies and books, and she's got plenty of company.
Half the world's population has been born since we stopped going to the moon.
Roger Lanius is a curator at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum.
In the true sense of the term, it's history for them.
NASA has long-term plans to put people back on the moon and go on to Mars. But young adults have grown up with routine space shuttle flights and tragedies like Challenger and Columbia. One survey a few years ago suggested that they aren't that enthusiastic about a moon mission. If the younger generation isn't as interested, that could be a problem for NASA, because today's kids will be tomorrow's voting taxpayers.
I'm Tice Kamaniak, and I'm 7.
And do you have any thoughts about whether or not people should be going to the moon?
That'd be good, but I don't really know, like, if they should or shouldn't, because... Yeah.
Well, like, for example, would you personally be interested if given an opportunity to get off the planet?
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Other kids, like Abby Jones and Alina Church, are more gung-ho.
I think it'd be really fun to walk on the moon and search everything, all the planets and asteroid belts.
I think that NASA should be returning... My friends, well, some of them, they are interested in space, and I know I am, but I'm not sure about other people around me.
If I go to a classroom today, it's different than when I went when I was an astronaut in 1980.
Charles Bolden is President Obama's pick to be the next head of NASA.
I could ask, how many of you want to be an astronaut? And every hand went up in the class.
These days, he says, he'll see maybe 3 hands.
But we do have to reinvigorate the interest of youth in this country if we're going to do anything.
So NASA is tweeting and Facebooking and trying to catch the attention of teenagers like August Hagen, who is, you know, kind of open to the idea.
Are you into moon exploration? Is an astronaut a career that you would ever consider?
I don't think I would consider it, but I think it might be an interesting just thing to study.
Why wouldn't you consider it?
I sort of have a fear of heights.
Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Urban renewal in the 1960s and 70s changed the landscape of many American cities. In Indianapolis, one African-American neighborhood was largely bulldozed to make way for new university buildings. Some say the school paid too little for that land. Now, archaeologists are finding evidence that the area was not as blighted as had been portrayed before it was destroyed, and they say the neighborhood's history may deserve a rewrite. From member station WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana, Daniel Robison reports.
When 86-year-old Tom Ridley pulls out a picture of a bustling Indiana Avenue during its heyday, he cradles it in his hand like an old family photo.
I carry papers down through here when I was a little boy. Here's some of the buildings that used to be on the avenue, like barbershops, grocery stores, shoe shops, anything you just about want.
The area was the economic center of the city's vibrant African-American community. It was known as a rowdy, post-prohibition jazz mecca, Oscar Robertson's playground, and home to cosmetics magnate Madam C.J. Walker, the nation's first female millionaire. Tom Ridley says Walker's factories propped up the neighborhood until waves of real estate agents started knocking on doors when property values declined in the late 1960s.
There's maybe 3 buildings left on the whole street.
Indiana University began buying up land here, 3,000 plots in total and razed the buildings to build a new regional campus as part of the city's urban renewal efforts. Now in place of jazz clubs and barbershops are acres of parking lots that line Indiana Avenue. Paul Mullins is an archaeology professor at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, who is leading the dig. He wants to unearth the truth about Indiana Avenue's 1960s reputation as a blighted neighborhood, one that he says made it easier for university officials to pay less for the land.
We want to complicate the dominant narrative that there was simply a declining, mostly African-American neighborhood here.
So far, the dig has turned up crystal light fixtures, medicine bottles, and other items suggesting middle-class wealth. Student Zach Harner says each item helps fill out the neighborhood's character.
When we dig through and we find things that people owned that obviously wouldn't belong in an area that was actually blighted, the notion that the area is blighted was probably what made it easier for the university to clear out the land.
Glenn Irwin was chancellor of the university at the time, and he defends its urban renewal plan. He says the school's efforts created thousands of jobs and brought millions of dollars to a stagnant neighborhood.
We paid a good price. We had real estate people bargaining on these all the time. These were the most dilapidated buildings you can imagine.
University of Illinois professor Chris Fennell says similar digs around the country are starting to draw attention to the cultural and historical importance of just what was lost in many American cities during their headlong rush toward urban renewal.
There's definitely a growing number of these nationwide, and it's a difficult process. But it's one that, at the end of the day, people move forward in their thinking by working through it, even though it's going to cast very awkward and negative lights on certain periods and certain players in American history.
Even though the vast majority of the neighborhood is missing, city leaders here began touting Indiana Avenue as a cultural destination for tourists a few years ago. But for Ridley, who has lived in the neighborhood for most of his 86 years, what's left in the dirt under parking lots can't make up for what was bulldozed.
So they can talk about, well, you know, bring it back, you know. If we had more of the old buildings still around, you could talk about some of the things that are around here. But we don't have that. See, they're gone. So all we can show them is a parking lot.
And it's those very parking lots that have kept the neighborhood's rubble so well intact. The items pulled from the dig will soon find a permanent home in one of Indiana Avenue's few remaining buildings, Madam Walker's Vaudeville Theater. For NPR News, I'm Daniel Robison in Indianapolis.
Along a quiet street in Burlingame, California, there is a small hole-in-the-wall museum dedicated to the pursuit of Pez. Now, you might think that the company that makes Pez candy would like this strange homage to Pez memorabilia, but it's more complicated than that. In fact, the company has sued the museum in federal court. David Gorn reports.
This place is as cramped as the inside of a Pez dispenser.
Adults are $3, kids 4 to 12 are $1.
The tour covers two rooms, each the size of a walk-in closet, crammed chock full of these colorful plastic heads. 800 of them. Joyce Lee drove about an hour to get here because this is Pez heaven.
It's really cool with all these collection of Pez. Who doesn't like Pez, right?
Well, it turns out that just because everyone likes Pez doesn't mean you can't have a fight over it. According to the store's owner, Gary Doss, Pez Candy Inc. wants to shut him down.
We're here promoting their product. We're embracing their product as a fun collectible. And we've been doing it for over 14 years.
Doss says this is not the first time he and Pez have crossed dispensers. When he first opened the place, Pez made him change the name from the Pez Museum to the mouthful it is now, the Burlingame Museum of Pez Memorabilia. Doss calls it harassment.
It's as if we're making something here and putting their name on it. That's not what we're doing.
But Pez Candy Inc. says that's exactly what the museum is doing. If it was just selling all things Pez, that'd be fine, they say. But they add, you can't sell things that aren't official merchandise, like Pez t-shirts the museum printed up. And you can't use that 7-foot-tall Pez dispenser the museum made that stands just inside the front door. Alan Baer is the lawyer for Pez Candy Inc. in Connecticut. He says it's not really a giant Pez dispenser because Pez doesn't make a giant dispenser.
It's only Pez if we say it's Pez, the same way that you will not see a Mickey Mouse in the United States made by anybody but Disney. It's only Mickey Mouse if Disney says it's Mickey Mouse. Otherwise, it's an infringement. You have to control what is core to your brand.
Baer and Pez CEO Joe Vittoria say Pez is a sweet company, that it has been supportive of the store and museum in Burlingame, but it is not supportive of trademark infringement. And the thing to understand is, Pez, which started out as a candy company in Austria in the 50s, is now a worldwide moneymaker. Pez collectors can pay thousands of dollars for a single tiny plastic dispenser. There are Pez conventions, Pez clubs. Pez has become iconic. It even became the storyline for a Seinfeld episode, the one where Elaine makes a scene by giggling uncontrollably, just looking at a Pez dispenser.
It was Jerry! Jerry put a Pez dispenser on my leg! Jerry put a Pez dispenser on her leg during my recital?
I didn't know she would laugh!
So Pez is not just a toy, it's a phenomenon. And maybe the final proof of its lofty status in American culture is that it's ending up in court. For NPR News, I'm David Gorn.
This is NPR National Public Radio.
In the Loop is a British political satire that takes place during the lead-up to the current war in Iraq. It's a comedic behind-the-scenes look at how the American and British governments prepared for war. It's from the writers and director of a British TV comedy called In the Thick of It, and features, among many others, James Gandolfini as an American general. It opens today in limited release and can be seen on pay-per-view cable beginning next week. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
With its wild machinations, the riotously potty-mouthed British political satire In the Loop seems totally outlandish. But according to some reports, it's more or less what happened in the days leading up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. The Brits were indeed drafted to supply intelligence to help the administration make its case to the U.N. Security Council. And according to a leaked Downing Street memo, intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. Inspired by that memo, director Armando Iannucci has concocted a rollicking transcontinental farce, a policy wonk version of The Front Page, with characters flying back and forth between London and Washington and enough four-letter scatological invective to make David Mamet say, "Whoa, that's a tad excessive." You'll be laughing so hard you might not notice the undercurrent of horror creeping in. The movie uses characters from Iannucci's Brit TV comedy In the Thick of It, starring the Scottish Peter Capaldi as a relentlessly abusive government press secretary named Malcolm Tucker, and based on Alastair Campbell, who did the job for Tony Blair. As the film opens, he's listening to a radio interview with a minor government minister named Simon Forster, played by Tom Hollander. And Simon stammers something about the war in the Middle East being, quote, unforeseeable. And as harmless as that locution seems, it drives the prime minister, who goes unnamed, and his executioner, Malcolm, into obscenity-laced fits of apoplexy. Here's Malcolm with Hollander Simon and Gina McKee as his press secretary and a new young spin doctor, Toby, played by Chris Addison.
Are you saying I'm now no longer allowed to make media appearances?
Correct. Not until we can trust you to keep the line.
No, I was going to keep to the line. I was going to say, I don't think war is unforeseeable.
What is it then?
I don't know. Foreseeable? No.
No! No! Not foreseeable. That's f***ing declaring war. Do you want to f***ing declare war?
I'm a cabinet minister.
Yeah.
I didn't get here by screwing up every media appearance I ever had.
Write this down. It's neither foreseeable nor unforeseeable.
Right. So, not inevitable, but not...
You better walk on this f***ing line.
Evitable.
You! Hey! put the snifter out there that if the BBC ambushes a minister with another surprise question about the war, I'll drop a bomb on them.
Well, I can't do that, can I?
Does that not fit within your purview, Marie Antoinette? Well, listen, why don't you just scuttle off back to Cranford and play around with your tea and your cakes and your horsecocks. Let them eat cock. Hey, you, Ron Weasley, you do it.
You'd hardly recognize Capaldi from his most famous movie role as Peter Riegert's lovelorn Scottish assistant in the sublime 1983 comedy Local Hero. The cords in his neck stand out as he roars, and he shows up everywhere, fulminating, threatening, blackballing, blackmailing. Against him, idealists don't stand a chance, and neither does Simon, who tries to backpedal from that unforeseeable line, but who does like the attention. He gets drafted as an ally by the dovish U.S. Assistant Secretary for Diplomacy, Karen Clark, played by Mimi Kennedy, who's locked in a battle with the hawkish State Department official Linton Barwick, based on top Cheney aide David Addington, and played with delicious smug pomposity by David Rashi. The movie is crammed with characters and details, the actors playing it straight but at farcical speeds, leaping back and forth from the minutiae of protocol to problems with their teeth, to one-night stands, to leaking documents or plugging leaks. In the Loop's loopy ensemble includes the pert Anna Chlumsky as Clark's policy aide, who drafts a highly inconvenient paper on the prospect of war in which the cons far outweigh the pros, and James Gandolfini as an alpha male general who's nonetheless dead set against war. He's the only one who's seen soldiers die. They're all stupendous, but it's Mimi Kennedy, best known as Dharma's mom on the sitcom Dharma and Greg, who blew me away. She has the doggedness of a true political animal. She has ideals, but she knows how the game must be played. Some critics have suggested that In the Loop is too cynical, too committed to the idea that politicians and policymakers are either hopelessly ineffectual or downright venal. But I would submit the lead-in to the war in Iraq was an extraordinary case, a moment when almost no one in retrospect looks good. And the filmmakers don't depict the principal architects or even mention Blair, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, or Colin Powell by name. Instead, we see their minions in a kind of kabuki ritual, going through the motions, the conclusion predetermined. In the Loop demonstrates how penetrating farce can be, madcap on the surface, brutally sane beneath.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.